quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
You need to make sure that they're good at actually executing. So making sure that you vet your partners and you get the good partnerships in place and you get the structure in place to make sure that everybody stays within the parameters of the agreement.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Best Ever listeners, welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm your host, Joe Cornwell, and today I'm joined by Jack Thomas. Jack is the president of Jetway Financial. He's a financial strategist, private lender, and manages real estate private equity funds. He is also investing in a resort and some hotel developments and is also a mortgage note investor. So he's got a wide variety of experiences. First time on the show, Jack, thank you so much for being here today.
Joe, thanks for having me. I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you joining us and sharing your wisdom. I guess since it's your first time, why don't we start with your background, where are you from, and how did you initially get into real estate?
I'm from the Windy City from Chicago. I got into real estate. When I left college, I was doing some IT network design and business sales from business to business. And my target demographic, my market vertical was financial. So I would design a network and sell it to banks, hedge funds, traders, medical and insurance companies. So along the way, I had to figure out what the pain points were, how the business models worked, what is it that they were doing with the money to get some returns and stay in business. So within that, I found real estate and I found it pretty quickly. So as I was able to form those relationships with those chief technology officers and chief financial officers, I just pumped them for information, Joe. And I was fortunate enough to that they were willing to share with me how the businesses worked. And from a banking perspective, money is truly debt and you're just leveraging debt to give out loans and you duplicate that over and over again to get passive returns. So most people think that the real estate is the actual asset, but the note is the asset. The real estate is just collateral for it. So I learned that pretty quickly. I became an accredited investor at 29, and before you know it, the company that I've been working for those 6 or 7 years, it was just interfering with me making my real money, which was real estate. So at that point, I just jumped on in full speed, and now I'm a full-time entrepreneur. I've been in this space for over 20 years at this point, and we're rocking and rolling.
That's great. So when did you go full-time in real estate and investing?
In 05, jumped in and 2003, and that 2 years, so that 18 months or so, I jumped right on in head first. And it was enough for me to go ahead and walk away from corporate, from a good paying corporate job at that.
So those first few years, and when you went full time, what was your primary asset that you're investing in? What did your strategy look like back then?
So back then, this was before the 08 bus. I was doing a ton of fix and flips. Got kind of caught in 08, actually, to be fully transparent, Joe. I was doing a bunch of single families. And at the point when 08 rolled around, I think I was doing 3 or 4 projects at the same time. And the market had dropped. In Chicago, we were on pace to get the Olympics. And the deal fell through. So the area that they were targeting, I was buying a lot of property over there. Easy point of entry. But when we didn't get that Olympics bid, it was a bloodbath. So first hard, maybe not the first hard lesson, but it was a hard lesson. But the secret is if you buy low, then you cash flow essentially. But make sure that you know your numbers, make sure that you know what your rehab costs are, and make sure that you know your after repair value. So even if the market shifts, then even if you're at the floor of the market as far as your debt service, you'll still be able to keep your head above water. So that was one of the lessons that I learned from dealing with that. But yeah.
Yeah, I saw a note in your background, and I'm assuming you're alluding to this, where it was don't speculate on gentrification. Is that the same deals?
Absolutely, Joe. It's funny. As we speculate the market, we don't know what's going to happen on the overall market. So we're anticipating, we got hopeism, right? But hope isn't necessarily a good business strategy. You've got to go with what's concrete, with what's actually working today. And that if something does pop, then that's great. Then you just got the cherry on top of your sundae. But you need to know what your numbers are, know what your worst case scenario is, and pretty much plan according to that. That way you don't lose your shirt.
Yeah. What I love about the whole debate between cash flow and appreciation, and the last 10 years has been predominantly focused on cash flow until the recent years with COVID. And then the market started to shift. Obviously, we saw massive values increasing during COVID years of 10, 20, 30% in some markets. And what's interesting to me is, yeah, hyperinflation, all those things that are adding to that. And it's interesting to me where, obviously we'll get into this, but you're investing in the Midwest. I'm a Midwest investor as well. And the key difference I see when I talk to people who invest in the Midwest or maybe in the Southeast versus like the coastal markets or Southwest is that those areas do have more traditional appreciation, more reliable. I say reliable loosely because obviously it's cyclical like everything else. But historically, they've appreciated much more rapidly than a lot of the Midwest and the old Rust Belt markets. Now, the difference, though, is historically and traditionally, Midwest markets have cash flow better because your values are going to be lower and your rent to cost ratios are higher. So what's interesting is as I've grown as an investor, you can find those pockets where your floor is kind of safe. You know, you're going to have some cash flow. And if you're on good fixed debt, it lowers your downside. But the contrast is maybe you don't have as much possible appreciation upside as you may have in other markets. So how has that driven you in determining the markets you have invested in over the last 20 years?
Fabulous question. So for me, because I'm a private lender as well. So as we lend money all over the United States. So I'm fortunate enough to actually see how different markets work. So I see that Southeast market, I see that California market, I see what the Midwest does, and then you see that Southern Belt. So what it does is it allows for me to have a unique understanding of what's going on nationally. So you could hedge your bets. To your point, the Midwest is blue collar. Not that it's anything against blue collar, but it's the core of what really drives and makes America work. So from that standpoint, the cost or the base of property value is lower. So it doesn't necessarily appreciate as much because those properties still have to maintain and be affordable for the working class. So you don't see a lot of great appreciation there, which for the national market is good because it keeps the U.S. balanced from that standpoint. But to your point, it keeps good cash flow. So cash flow is what you need when the market shifts. So as I look at it, I think of the Midwest is great for cash flow. You want to get in at a low price point. You want to make sure that you get your cash flow, but you might want to invest in other markets if you're looking for appreciated growth. So you got to kind of mix your plays and think about strategy and form your strategy of how you want to park money and the time frame that you want to park money. So you really want to set yourself up to be on the polar opposite of whatever the market is commanding and multiple markets. So like if you're investing in multiple markets and you have a polar strategy in the Midwest versus a different strategy in, say, California or the Southeast, it allows you to get the best of both worlds. So when the market shifts over here, you're still winning, and the market shifts over there, you could go ahead and cash out and get your cash and then use that cash to go down and buy some more cash flowing assets that are at a lower price point. So you got to think through it. You got to think for the long term and mix your plays as you're analyzing that.
And what's interesting to me is that, and I'm sure you have experienced this with markets all over the country, as you mentioned, but when you break down like Midwest market, and I know you said you started in Chicago, I know you said you're investing in Indianapolis as well, and I'm in Cincinnati, all kind of similar Midwestern cities and have similarities. So what's interesting is when you break down all those neighborhoods, because these metros are almost always made up of, you got your core proper city proper limits, and then you got your suburbs, and they got a lot of diversity in all of those neighborhoods and job types and incomes and all those things. Most of these have some really high end suburbs. Some have some lower end where it's lower incomes and higher crime. But when you make these diverse investments all over, even in one city, let's say, you get access to some of that upside. And the point you made about the Olympics is like a prime example. You could use that type of black swan event or whatever, right? Where something you didn't even think could happen. And then all of a sudden it happens and boom, your values double, triple. So like one example here in Cincinnati was when the FC Cincinnati team became pro. So they were a semi-pro team for however many years. And then all of a sudden, boom, they got brought up into the MLS and they had to build this $500 million stadium. And they built it in the West End, which was like historically low income, high crime neighborhood. And boom, all of a sudden people holding in that neighborhood 4, 5, 6x values on their properties overnight. It's wild how some of these events can happen like that.
Let me piggyback on what you're saying. And think about this too, right? This is a low-hanging fruit that a lot of investors don't even realize or even go after. So like if you go to like the PUT meetings, you know, or to any of the community organizations to where, so, or even if you go down to the urban planning office, all of this information is public information. So you could go to those urban planning offices and actually see what they're targeting, what areas that they are targeting to do some growth in. That's where you might want to go ahead and get involved in at an early pace. Now, it might take a little time for it to come around, but that's what it is that you're looking at if you're doing projections or if you're doing speculating. So food for thought. Sometimes it hits off like a grand slam, and then other times it's a slower drag depending upon whatever that metric that they're going to place into that market.
And I think that's why the cash flow conversation is so important because, again, if you're buying in some of these fringe areas where you're hoping on appreciation, maybe you're hoping on gentrification, or you're hoping on some big investment from a corporation or the government or whatever, if you're cash flowing, if you're in a stable asset, then you have that long runway if you need to hold on 5, 10, 15 years for some of that upside to maybe happen. All right, so shifting gears a little bit, you mentioned how you got into note investing. So tell me how that even started for you. Why did you get into note investing? Because obviously not a ton of people are doing that.
It was God, really. I don't know how spiritual you are, but I stumbled into it. This was after 08. I made it through the real estate downturn. Did pretty good. At that point, I was about 10 years into my real estate career. I had made it through 08. I had migrated out. I picked up some insurance licenses. So I was selling some high-end sophisticated insurance products, really as a financial tool. And what happened was, you know how it is, you're a credit investor, you get all of these calls. And at that time, I wasn't sophisticated enough to acquire assets in an entity name. I was still out there buying them in my personal name. So I got called from a lot of these investors or whoever that targets accredited investors. So anything from like oil wells to Disney Pixar movies and stuff like that, I didn't know anything about any of that stuff, right? So I was leery, didn't get into the market. And then especially after 08, I'm gun shy, right? Risk averse. I ended up getting a call from this private banking school out of Silicon Valley. And it's my phone, so I'm answering my calls. You get some good deals sometimes that way. So they go into the pitch, and I'm listening, I'm entertaining, I'm a nice guy. And the guy was like, hey, well, do you know how banks make money? Of course I know how banks make money. I sold them network structure for years. They make money on loans. They loan in 4 different areas, and then they leverage that, and they do it over again. That's how banks make money. Then it was like, have you ever thought about what banks do with their profits, how they turn that money into more money? And I was like, actually, no, I didn't think about that. And it's like, well, that's what we teach. I was like, when is class? And then it gave me the data. I was like, I'll see you on Monday. So that was the beginning of it. It was a class, and the guy was extremely intelligent, extremely smart, had been in private banking for years, and was doing private lending. And for me, I caught it immediately because I had the experience of working with those traders and lenders and chief financial officers. But then I also had the additional experience in working in insurances for years at that point. So what I knew was that at the core of what we think is money is actually the notes. And I didn't realize that how it's all essentially the same. So, Joe, I learned what a core concept is. And what I realized is very few core concepts. And everything else is just an application of that concept. So I was able to catch the concept of notes at its core and the application of how money is made from understanding what the note is at its core. So from that standpoint, it was like, oh, I'm shifting everything about my business to be centered around like these new strategies. And that's what it was. So, and it helped me migrate from single family to multi-units to private lending to hotels and now to resorts. So it's understanding what money truly is at its root, understanding the several applications of it, and being able to duplicate that process over and over again. And that's what creates the passive income. And once you automate that, you put a faster velocity on your return. So it's from understanding the core and learning things along the way and being in the right spaces in the right rooms and just applying that information and forming relationships, scaling out your team. You know, I got a team of attorneys that I leverage their intellect and their resources to get me into further spaces and the further asset classes that I didn't even anticipate or know that I could even get into. So long-winded story to your question.
I appreciate the background. So when you started, you said it's about 10 years ago when you started doing the note investing. Is that right?
Yeah, probably a little over 10 years at this point. Yep.
Okay. So what did those first couple investments look like? Give me some examples of like the types of deals or types of investments you were making.
Listen, you're going to laugh at this, Joe. The first investment that I did on the note investment, I effed up big time. I did exactly what the instructor told you not to do. I raised money from family, and you were supposed to lend money to actual real estate. And what I did at the time, it was some guys that called on me, and I took a liking to them. And I bought into what it is that they were attempting to do, the hopism that they had. They were going to buy the studio in Atlanta. It was for $2 million, and they only needed down payment money. So you're never supposed to lend on the down payment money because that's the money that's the most at risk. But I felt like if I could get some collateral for that capital, then we could work it out. And that was just simply because I liked the guys. Blew up in my face. What ended up happening is one of the partners that was the borrower, he had played a game to whereas him and his dad had the same name, different suffixes. One was the junior, one was the third, and the third was the one that didn't own the asset. But the way that the paperwork on the property and all of the assets attached to it, it was really the dad's, but he was posing as if it was his because the name and they. So long story long, on that deal, didn't have any security on it, did win a judgment on it. The judgment was only as good as the paper that it was written on because you couldn't collect because these guys, they had all of that stuff tied into one of these ironclad trusts. You can't get it out of the trust, which led me into finding out how to do that trust. So like from the mistakes that I fall forward as opposed to just taking the beating on it. So I was fortunate enough to learn from going through that whole process to stick to your lending criteria, not deviate from that, making sure that you have good borrowers in place and help through educating your borrowers about what makes money work, what makes deals work, and what protects them and how that protects us all. And then we could do repeat business over and over again. And then I educate them on some other additional advanced strategies, some secret codes of wealth to help them along the way to secure their money, reduce their tax exposure, and put more money into play for future generations.
So on that deal, if you don't mind sharing, you were raising money from others and kind of pulling it to make this note investment. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's exactly correct. Yep.
Okay. Do you know how much total was lost? How much did you personally lose?
So on that deal, total $70,000 was the down payment they needed on it. So it wasn't a big deal, but I took family money. So I did raise money with family. So when it went left, they're looking at me crazy. Thanksgivings were rough, you know what I mean? So I ended up paying it back out of pocket over a year or two. But at the same time, still family members now that are looking like, we still remember that and we're not forgetting. So hard, tough, but lesson. Regardless of how successful that I am at this point, it's still back like, I remember nephew. So that's a real thing. Real hard lesson to learn. I won't make that error and mistake again.
Yeah, it's tough anytime you mix family and business. It gets challenging. I'll give a couple examples. So I own a construction business. I'm also an agent here in Cincinnati. People call me all the time, friends and family. People I've been friends with for 20 years, family obviously. And they want to work with me and they want to support my business, which is great. Obviously, I love that. I love the support. I love working with them. But Then it's like, are people working with me because they want a deal? Are they working with me because they really want that experience because they my company and what it has to offer? And it gets difficult. And then if things don't go as planned, maybe there are a misalignment of expectations. And now maybe you're upset or the customer's upset. So it bleeds over. And then obviously, of course, when you're investing money with family or raising money with family, it creates a lot of challenges. So it's tough. It's hard for a lot of people to navigate. And then the flip side, though, right? As investors, our job is to go out there and create a return on capital. So whether it's our capital, whether we're raising money or a mix. And then it's like, well, do you not allow them the opportunity to raise a return on their capital because you're not allowing them to invest with you? So that can become a challenge. They see you having success, they see you making money, and they want to be included in that opportunity. So there's a lot to navigate there, and it can get challenging. And it's almost like you can be damned if you do, damned if you don't, so to speak. But yeah, I appreciate the candidness. I appreciate you sharing that story. And obviously, sometimes it's harder to talk about our losses than our wins. So we definitely appreciate you sharing that. So let's continue on the note thing. How did that expand and kind of bring us up to today? How did that evolve over time?
So from that experience, what I ended up learning is how to properly secure a deal. Well, I knew how to secure a deal. Now I knew definitely how to execute on the deal. But along with that, it also made me tighten up the way of which that I raise capital. So now we have to get a more defined structure to your participation agreements, joint venture agreements, if you're using joint venture, and then if you migrate into the private equity space and your private placement memorandum, right? So I had to get more sophisticated with how I was structuring my deals. So when you look at anything that you do in real estate, right? It sounds like you've been in it a long time, from owning your own construction company to being a realtor. When you create companies, entities, whatever, it's all about the structure and the strategic plan that you have for where you're going to take your business, right? So with that structure, whatever entity is that you create, you want to make sure that you have good tax strategy for it, good accounting for it. So when you place whatever the asset is, it doesn't matter whether it's a paper asset or whether it is the real property as the asset. But for me, because my assets were paper, I had to make sure that the structure was good, the execution on how I raised money, how I deployed money was good, and making sure that the other elements that we had to make sure that if there was a default, how we could protect ourselves from the default without damaging the borrower. So if we chose to work with the borrower in the future, as we rehab the borrower, then we could go ahead and get them back into play after we teach the right tool set so that it could be effective and actually be profitable in this business.
We'll get back to the show. But first, some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane. And it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
I have a follow-up question because I'm trying to visualize this and I'm sure our audience is as well. So walk me through an example deal from start to finish. What does it look like? What is the expected returns? How do you make your money? And then how do you exit that? So give me an example.
Say for example, let's say that we're originating this loan, meaning that we're creating the loan. So I get a call. I'll give you a real case scenario. So it was some college buddies of mine that wanted to go ahead and create their own investment club. They wanted to buy a multi-unit apartment complex in Chicago. So what I did for them was I said, okay, my company will lend you guys some money, but we have lending criteria. Make sure that you hit the lending criteria. We'll give you 65% of the loan of value. If that property needs any improvements, we'll give you up to 65% of the after repair value. It needed some cosmetic stuff. They ended up finding a great deal their deal, even with their debt on it, they were going to net 36% on the money. So those guys did great with how they sourced deals. So I lent them the funds, and it was a low value too. And this was over a decade ago, but this property, I think the acquisition cost was like $55,000. I think they only needed $10,000 or $12,000 for the paint and the cosmetic and changing some fixtures and stuff like that. And then at that point, they were going to go ahead and hold the property for a period of time. So for them, I gave them the 65% of whatever the after repair value was. So the total loan of cost on it was under 55%. So it made it extremely attractive to us. So I got a feeling you're probably going to ask a follow-up question on this, so I'll let you get to it. So for us, the leverage is, the lower that the loan of cost is, it lowers the risk for the investor, it lowers the risk for us as the lender. So it was attractive, it was great. So we gave them a low rate. I think the rate might have been 10% or something like that. No, actually, this was right after 08, so they might have paid like 13, 14% or something like that. But for those guys, again, they were at 36%. So it was cash flowing, it was four units. They had a 24-month note, and they were able to get out of that thing, I want to say like within the first 10 months or so. So once the rehab was complete, some of the tenants were already in place. They updated and replaced some of the tenants that had left. And then we refinanced them into a permanent loan situation. And they ended up selling out of that property, actually, maybe a few months right after they had refinanced. I think it was some internal situations with the group. But yeah, but they got out of it pretty good. So they exited pretty well, yeah.
Okay, so 24-month term on the note. Now, is this paid interest paid monthly? Is it interest-only payments? How do you structure that?
Yeah, so that's interest only. Yeah, so I think they were maybe between 10 to 13% interest only for that 24 months.
Okay, so similar to like hard money terms.
No, I think they had a 12-month term. I don't think they had a 24-month. I think they only had a 12-month term. Yeah.
Okay, so similar to like a hard money term company. Okay. And I can think of a couple reasons, but I'll let you answer. Why are people coming to you for these type of notes versus the bank?
Oh, well, I'm certain you could answer that. It's pretty much, they don't qualify for conventional lending, right? They might not have tax returns. Their credit might be a little challenged. They may not have the experience to show to the traditional lender that I could go ahead and get out of this. So we give an asset-based loan. Amount of loan is based upon what the true value of that property is worth. So we're able to move as quickly as they could shuffle the paper. So if they have the necessary documents that we need, most of it is going to come down to appraisal and title and insurance. If they could produce all of those docs at a short period of time, we could close right after title clears it.
Okay. Now, is this in a real estate fund where you're raising money from outside investors and then you're finding deals to lend these into? Is this just all personal money? How does that side of it work?
Great question. So when I started out, it was really like a combination of all of the above. It was some of my own money. It was some money that I raised from other people. We did joint ventures. We did participation agreements when we got a little more sophisticated. And then we just lent money. So if I found a good deal, then I would send it out to a list of my capital partners. They had the first right of refusal. We had done business with them before, whether they participated on some fix and flips from years before, or we used to do a lot of lunch and learns and a lot of different things to educate on different strategies. So we had a short list of preferred partners. We send that out to that short list of those preferred partners. They like the deal, and first one to raise their hand and get their money in, that's who made the interest on that deal. Sometimes it went quicker than others, and that's how it was. Now I've grown since that space. We're doing private equity where we raise money through a fund, but it's still a similar process. We got a short list of limited partners that want to get that passive return. If they like the deal, once I submit it to the group, the first guy's in, they get the return. If it fills out pretty fast, then, hey, we'll put you in line for the next deal and the next opportunity, but you got to be ready.
Okay, so it's almost like you're pairing, in most cases, one passive investor to one borrower. Is there deals that may be larger where you're pairing three, four?
Most definitely. For example, we participated as a limited partner into a hotel package. So, and it was through what they call the syndication. So with that syndication, we had to create a fund for it. And with that fund that we created, we took multiple investors, whatever the comfort on the investment level. Some came in at the minimum, some came in greater. But we had a target amount that we were looking to raise for that hotel investment. Once we hit it, Then we ended up investing directly into that hotel package. But for that hotel package, we did it amongst four investors.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be my next transition. So let's talk a little bit about some of these hotel deals you're in. Are you lending on these in your note placement company, or are you personally investing actively in these hotel deals?
Yes. So the answer is yes and no. We're doing it, again, through syndication, and we created a private equity fund for it. So we have a private placement memorandum, which gives the investors, those limited partners, it outlines exactly what the deal is, the summary of the deal, and it outlines all of the risk factors that are in the deal. So it doesn't just give them the hopeism. It also lets them know that, by the way, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. And if those things happen, we might not necessarily get the return of which that we're anticipating, because we're absolutely projecting the type of returns that the property is going to generate. We're only projecting it based upon previous experience and then whatever property improvement programs that we put into the hotel for it to garner a return, for it to garner a higher nightly rate, which would increase the NOI, the net operating income. And then that's where we could go ahead and pay the dividend returns quarterly. So probably what you're thinking is, okay, when I initially started off with private lending or raising money, now whereas I didn't have a complete structure, now I have a way more sophisticated structure to set expectations with your capital partners, so that you need to understand that we're all in this together. But because we're all in together, you're going to get your return before we get our return. But we're also sharing in the risk that goes along with it. And here are the risks, so you're not shooting in the dark, so you're not blinded to the fact of something that we might face along the way. So like that strategy a whole lot better, because everybody comes to the table knowing what it is, because it's a hefty page doc that we tell them, look, review this with your attorney, review it with your accountant, make sure that you follow up with it. But I want to highlight these things for you, so it's not anything that you do miss, so that we're all on the same page, because we can't afford any confusion in this process, because it's a lot of balls in the air and it's a lot of things that are moving to make any real estate transaction work. But most definitely when you're talking about an asset class such as hospitality, whereas you're dealing with people, like if people show up for the hotel or not, you're dealing with contracts that they're conventions in towns, or there's all of these other factors that are drivers that that manager of that hotel could capture that business. Then that's another thing. We got to make sure that we got the right operators that are in place, so they go out and hire and train and make sure that the staff that runs and manages the hotel are there, and that they're going out and they're actually capturing business that's above and beyond what they call the STAR report. It's a report that comes out monthly, and it gives you the updates as far as what your occupancy rates are, which your average daily rates that you'll see within that certain market. So you're armed with tools, but you have to actually utilize all of your tools to make sure that you get the returns it is projecting that you're going to get.
Okay. And my last line of question here is, why did you transition? What was the motivation or the experience that had you transition into investing into hotel development? And then obviously, I know we briefly mentioned the resort development you're working on. So yeah, take me through that process.
You play Monopoly, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'm a strategist, right? I love strategy. I love thinking through process. I love thinking through how to reverse engineer from where you are currently to where you get into the winner's circle, right? You know how it is, Joe. The bigger the asset class, the bigger the return, the bigger the rewards are. You're doing the same level of work that you are doing with a single family. You're just not getting the reward for it. So coming from that space, it was like, okay, well, I want to create more wealth for people that I care about, for the legacy that I leave behind as well. So to do that, I need to step it up. I need to scale. That's the whole point of business. You want to scale your business. You want to scale the asset class. You want to scale the teams that will help you do that. And that's what it was for me. So from having success in those areas, the next thing was, okay, well, yeah, we're successful, but what kind of impact are we really truly leaving on the world? What kind of impact are we leaving in the markets that we're investing in? What kind of impact are we creating for those people that may not necessarily get, you know, like sometimes when you over improve an area, the people that were there before you got to that area, that it might create some financial hardship for them, right? So from being in a space to investing for 20 years and then being in a space for lending for 10 years and then having success in it all, regardless of whatever ups and downs that you have, like, what is it that I'm going to do that's going to create the best impact that could sustain those areas of which that we live, work, and play in? So my strategic thinking hat on, okay, well, what makes these areas that are affluent, what makes them sustainable? What makes these areas that are not affluent, what makes them not sustainable? So what I ended up forming and formulating is a sustainability model. So now when we look at developments, doesn't matter whether it's residential, commercial, hospitality, special purpose, like college dorms or student housing, or whether it's assisted living or something for vision and hearing impaired, what we apply is the sustainability model. And from that sustainability model, a sustainable luxury property development, sustainable materials, sustainable practices of which that we build in, sustainable utility, so we do wind, water, and solar, sustainable economics. So we created a community development corporation. That community development corporation is international. That's a nonprofit that's attached. We partner with that community development corporation so that we could get some additional grants and some additional funding that we could use for a small business development, workforce training, access to capital, and sustainable food, one of the most important things. So when you look at certain communities, some of them are in food deserts, right? The more affluent are not. And then when you look at diet, the different studies behind it, you'll see that disease and illness states are heightened in areas that are not sustainable. So the sustainable food is hydroponic and aquaponic farming in urban areas, and we do agricultural neighborhoods and rural areas. So that's our four-legged sustainability stool, and we apply it on all aspects of real estate development. So that's us having a bigger vision, a bigger goal, so that we could create more impact. And it just so happens from creating that impact and bringing that value, it increases the value on the developments at a 1-to-4 ratio. So it becomes more profitable for us, more profitable for our investors, more profitable for our partners, and it's more effective for the inhabitants within those communities or within those countries. So that's what we do.
That's great. It's a win-win-win, and I like it. I appreciate you sharing that with us. All right, we're running up on time here, so let's switch over to the best ever lightning round. You ready?
Let's do it.
All right, give me your best ever book recommendation.
I'm an avid reader, so I could do this all night. But one of the best books that I read was a book in college. I'm dating myself. It was in the late 90s. But the book was Strategically Thinking. And what it taught was to get outside of the box and think of creative ways to create strategies that you create win-win-win solutions. So still applying it to this.
Well, yeah, I would say that seems like to be your mantra. So I'm glad you could share that with us. All right. Best ever way you like to give back?
I like to help. God put me here to be a servant. So I just serve. I give him whatever capacity that he commands of me. So if it's in resources and information, I give it willingly. I give it freely. Don't expect anything in return. It just so happens that I end up getting blessed from it. Not the reason why I do it, but it just so happens that that's how it works. It's crazy that way.
Give me a different mistake you made and a lesson you learned from it. I know you told us a good one, but do you have another one?
Strategic partnership. Choosing your partners. Sometimes you get involved with people that you like. You get involved with people that have like-mindedness and have good vision as far as goal, or you have the same goal. But execution, you need to make sure that they're good at actually executing. So making sure that you vet your partners and you get the good partnerships in place and you get the structure in place to make sure that everybody stays within the parameters of the agreement.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And as I've gotten more experience and did more partnerships, it's like finding someone who's truly complimentary. I think that's one of the hardest parts, because it's like, you know, I have a lot of investor friends who I love and I'd love to partner with them. But if we have all the same skill sets and abilities and resources, it doesn't really necessarily make for a good partnership just because you like and trust somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds like along the way you've had to exit some partnerships as well. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but it happens.
And my last question for you is, where can people connect with you and find more about your business and what you guys are doing?
You can find me on LinkedIn. That's Jack Thomas III on LinkedIn. I think you have a LinkedIn link. You could post it as well. Find me on jetwayfinancial.com, and that's JETWAY financial.com. still trying to get this website off the ground, and that is Code of Wealth, and that's where I'll just dump a bunch of content that's part of what it is that we're giving back, and it's just resources on top of information on top of strategy that anybody that's there that could join it and get all of the insight for different strategies that we put together for friends and for clients as they were building their businesses or building their brands or building their development. We got some good guys that, one of which, based upon a strategy, he went on and created a company that's now a $1 billion company. We've got one guy that went on and from some of the things it is that we talked about in strategy or just setting up strategy, he went on and created a development that went from $0 to $30 million in 18 months. So we'll let them tell their stories and all of that stuff will be available on that codeofwealth.com website. But we're still working on it. So hopefully by the time this airs, it'll be up and running. And then, of course, if you want to follow what we're doing in the Caribbean with our resort development, you can see that at ezumanoir.com, and that's ExumaNoire.com. And you can follow along and check us out. And if you want to join us in it, there's a possibility for you to do that as well.
Awesome, man. We'll be sure to link to your websites there. I really appreciate your time talking to us about your notes and your 20 years of experience. Jack, I appreciate your time and joining us today.
Joe, I really appreciate you for inviting me along on this podcast. This has been amazing. You're definitely good at this.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And audience, thank you all for tuning in. Best ever listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to share it with someone who may gain value from it. Make sure you follow and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss anything. Thank you all and have a best ever day.
Hi, best ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and best ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the best ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.